walks into a talent agent's office and he says, I got an act for you. And he opens his laptop and he opens the Zoom meeting. And there's this New Yorker journalist who's just like jacking it, just going to town. And, you know, this journalist, not really something to look at. And so he finishes. The guy doesn't even know his camera's on. Then he closes the computer. Talent agent says, well, that's I don't know if it's for me. It's not really my style of comedy, but it's definitely objectively quite an act. What do you call it? And you know what he says? He says The Aristocrats. Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone. We got lots to talk about today, but I mean, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the most obvious thing that's on everyone's mind, which is, what are we calling it? Tubingate?
L'affaire Tubin?
L'affaire Tubin.
I mean, there but for the grace of God go all of us, am I right?
This is one of those stories that only gets better when you read up on the details. I'm sure some people listening, you know, they're aware of the basic, you know, the contours because they saw it on their feed or whatever, which is Jeffrey Toobin, the marquee current affairs writer. You know, he wrote the big book about the O.J. Simpson trial.
The one that was turned into the miniseries.
That's right. The American Crime Story miniseries. You know, he's a sort of New York media man about town. He pulled his dick out on a Zoom call. This was initially reported.
He didn't just pull it out.
Well, so this was the thing. When it was initially reported, it was just, Jeffrey Toobin suspended after, flashing his dick on a Zoom call.
Bathrobe incident, basically. Could happen to the best of us.
Yeah, I mean, I figured, like, they were probably having some long meeting or something. And, you know, it's like, the camera's looking into his apartment and he just didn't realize the camera's on or whatever. And, like, I don't know. I thought maybe there's an outside chance. Like, is it possible he was really bored and he was listening to the call via his, like, computer speaker? And he
just started playing a little bit absentmindedly.
I figured he might have muted and like picked up his laptop and like gone into the bathroom to take a piss or something like that. It was updated in one of, I think what has got to count is one of the all-time greatest updates to a story ever, where the headline just went from the more generic thing that we've been describing to New Yorker suspends Jeffrey Toobin for masturbating on Zoom call. So this also retroactively makes his apology and excuse even funnier, because initially when this was reported, he said, quote, I made an embarrassingly stupid mistake believing I was off camera. I apologize to my wife, family, friends, and coworkers. So when I initially read it, who knows, maybe he has a desk or something that the camera angle like looked into his washroom, he didn't close the door, whatever. But given what we now know about what he was doing, I mean, I love the excuse believing I was off camera. Like, oh, you'll have to forgive me. I was on a work call and I what they were doing is funny to me. And just like, yeah, makes this even funnier because they were playing some kind of election simulation game. Now, I can't figure out if this was something that they were like
professionally obligated to do.
Yeah, or
is this some practical function of it?
Is this what New Yorker writers are like required to do?
Or is it a lunch hour, like a club that they take part in, like election club?
Yeah, this is like, that thing where like you have like an office social, you don't get a lunch break and you have to fraternize with your colleagues. It's the New Yorker, so it's like politics nerd shit. But yeah, so in the Vice article, it says here, the call was an election simulation featuring many of the New Yorker's biggest stars. Jane Mayer was playing establishment Republicans. Evan Osnos was playing Joe Biden. Jelani Cobb was establishment Democrats. Masha Gessen played Donald Trump. Andrew Marantz was the far right Sue Halpern was left wing Democrats. Dexter Filkins was the military. And Jeffrey Toobin played the courts. Wow, just what the courts needed. A further blow to their legitimacy. Sorry, but I have to read on for those who haven't read up on the details here. There were also a handful of other producers on the call from The New Yorker and WNYC. Both people who spoke on the condition of anonymity in order to speak freely noted it was unclear how much each person saw, but both said they saw Toobin jerking off. The two sources described the juncture in the election simulation when there was a strategy session and the Democrats and Republicans went into their respective breakout rooms for about 10 minutes. At this point, they said it seemed like Toobin was on a second video call. I'm just picturing it. It's very funny.
His video call was to the Bang Bros. Maybe you've heard of them.
The sources said that when the groups returned from their breakout rooms, Toobin lowered the camera. I mean, I think there might be something else going on here.
That's interesting, because if he lowered the camera, that means he wasn't watching porn.
Yeah, or like, I love the detail of like, it looked like he was on a second video call, because, I mean, maybe he was on a second video call. The people on the call said they could see Toobin touching his penis. Toobin then left the call. Moments later, he came back in, seemingly unaware of what his colleagues had been able to see, and the simulation continued. So what I like is the idea that, like, you know, forget my conspiracy theory about him being on a second video call. What I like is just that Jeffrey Toobin is so aroused by the idea of democracy in action that he just couldn't help himself. He loves the idea of bourgeois jurisprudence so much that getting to play it, you know, he was just getting in character.
You know what I hate is when people want to suck the fun out of this by saying, ugh, I can't believe we're still talking about Jeffrey Toobin. It's day two of this Jeffrey Toobin thing. Like, can't we move on to more important matters?
Right. Like, yeah, more important matters, like Trump saying he looks better than JFK or something. Like, can we just get back to being outraged about real injustices?
I'll tell you what real justice is. Real justice is when a member of the mainstream media gets caught jacking off on camera. Like, that's a win for democracy.
Can I have a slightly contrarian take here that I just want to enter into the official record, which is, okay. I don't know. I mean, this is very prudish of me, but what is the public interest case for this, aside from it being very funny?
I mean, by official standards, by the corrupt mainstream standards, there is no public interest, but this is street justice, you know? The mainstream media has let us down, and so this is how we're going to delegitimize it, bit by bit.
We need the vigilante's advice to help us break it up from the inside. Anyway, very embarrassing. This is probably what Jeffrey Toobin will be remembered for the rest of his career.
God, that's incredible, isn't it? Just like your whole life can change in the blink of an eye with an unthinking decision. This could literally happen to me during this call.
Well, and I mean, I often don't report what's going on your webcam because I'm too professional. But I mean, I suppose on the other hand, there's a very real possibility that people will simply forget about this, or that they'll forget about it. Like, it will lose the potency that it has right now. I mean, it's such a hack thing to bring up in this context, but I think to this day, the only episode of the show Black Mirror I've seen is that one about the pig. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, well, I haven't seen it, but I know it by reputation. That was based on that famous true story.
Well, it wasn't based on it, I don't think. Like, it happened, and then...
Oh, and then, oh, right. And then the That's David why Cameron it kept thing. Getting...
Yeah,
that,
right.
So I kept getting brought up at that time.
But there's a detail at the end of that that I quite like, and I think is kind of like fairly imaginative, really, and possibly quite realistic, which is why I'm bringing it up here, which is that there's a little epilogue sequence where it's like a year after Piggate or whatever, and the prime minister is still the prime minister, and the nation has just kind of moved on from this, mm-hmm. right? And the only person that hasn't been able to move on from it is his wife. It ended up being very humiliating, you know, in the fictional world of Black Mirror, prime minister having to have sex with a pig on national television and the whole nation tweeting through it. You know, all the people that partook in it, you know, on Twitter and just kind of had fun with it, they actually don't care in a way, but only to people who he's intimate with has it really, you know, had an impact. And I wonder if something like this in a year, if this is just like an amusing curiosity or whatever. And like, then, you know, 10 years from now, people are like, oh, Jeffrey Toobin, that's the guy that wrote the OJ book. And like, didn't he have, what was that thing that was embarrassing or, you know, like.
Actually, I think you're right. Because like when Pee Wee Herman gets caught jacking off at a movie theater, like Pee Wee Herman is a cultural icon. He's one of the most famous children's entertainers.
I didn't know about that story. So there you
go.
Oh,
you didn't? Okay, well, trust me. He got caught jacking off in a movie theater. One of the most famous children's entertainers in the country. So already he's like gigantic. The act itself is so kind of dichotomous with his public image, but also sort of like weirdly in keeping with his public image as a sort of a like ambivalently queer avant-garde entertainer. So like a scandal like that came to define his entire life. But yeah, Jeffrey Toobin, he's just like, you know, one of many fucking gray haired.
Yeah, he's synonymous with sort of upright, you know, normie, normcore kind of current affairs writing.
Nobody really cares about him that much. So it's not really an epoch-defining scandal. It's not something that will ruin anybody's childhood.
You know what I think is incredible is that something like this hasn't happened sooner.
Yeah. Well, maybe it has, and, you know, the elites have just covered it up.
Open your third eye, people.
Did you see O.J. Simpson's epic bacon own of Jeffrey Toobin the other day on YouTube?
Yeah, you know, I went from thinking that was kind of like very funny and surreal to having, yeah, that basically that take on it, which is like, yeah, actually this sucks.
It's a little sinister, isn't it? I mean, it made me wonder if like, could Woody Allen just rehabilitate his reputation overnight if he just started posting like epic bacon viral content owning people? Could James Toback... Could Harvey Weinstein, like, start posting, like, funny, ironic videos and become beloved online people?
Well, that's what I really liked was your Harvey Weinstein, your tweet about this, where it's like, hey, y'all, it's your boy Harvey Weinstein. Just saw the news about Jeffrey Toobin and, dude, let's just say I thought I was indiscreet. And then you've got, like, the replies and they're, like, people going, lol, I would like to report a murder. Like, get his ass, Harv. And, like, you know, yeah, sir, you've won the internet, etc. Which, like, you joke, but that is what would happen, which is why this isn't actually funny.
Anyway, O.J. Simpson was found innocent by a jury of his peers.
Well, thanks for that. Anyway, I'm not sure how to segue out of that, but I am on my my second week of vacation this week, and apart from podcasting, I'm just kind of reading and going for walks and watching movies and stuff like that. There's not a whole lot to do in Toronto right now. Things are we've just gone back into an earlier stage of lockdown.
And it's cold and it's rainy, you know.
Yeah, it's not particularly pleasant. Before we started recording, Will was telling me you were saying the weather was kind of getting you down yesterday, and
I get very easily affected by the weather, I think, and something about how, you know, it's been rainy all week. It's going to be rainy for the rest of the week. It's getting colder. The amount of things you can do in a pandemic are gradually becoming more and more limited, and so I've been getting this big sense of claustrophobia lately, and I don't like it.
Yeah, this is not particularly funny or interesting, but I guess since everybody is, you know, basically, I mean, depending on where they're listening in varying degrees, is going through a version of this. But the way Will and I have experienced it, and everyone who lives in Toronto has experienced the pandemic, is, you know, we went through that initial stage, like I think everywhere did, where this thing was new, it was scary, and things were really locked down for a while. I guess the even earlier stage was everywhere with kind of inept right-wing governance, which is what we've got here in Ontario, also went through a stage where, you know, political leaders were saying, you know, hey, go enjoy your March break. Don't worry about this. It's not a big deal. And then we went into lockdown. But then after, you know, a couple months, the, you know, new cases each day started dropping, and it was the summer. Things were warm. So everything was kind of opening up again. Gyms reopened, things like that. You could be out on patios without a mask. You just have to wear a mask as you were going into the restaurant. It basically felt like, you know, there was like a linear trajectory to things. And now it definitely doesn't feel that way because things are getting colder, they're getting less pleasant, and fewer things are open, and there's even less to do. I think sort of retreating to the sort of purgatory of things being locked down with kind of no end in sight makes the current moment for COVID considerably worse than any of the earlier ones. But I will just say, I have been able to relax quite a lot. It's nice to not have to churn out thousands of words every week. Last week, I had to do a fair bit of podcasting in addition to our own podcast, so that kind of tired me out. And this week, things are a lot clearer. So it's amazing when you have that kind of time, the spaces of your brain, it frees up, you know, that are normally taken up by other things. And it's in moments like these that I find myself very enthusiastic about watching films, reading things that I've been putting off, or, you know, haven't been able to summon the enthusiasm on any particular, you know, afternoon or evening to watch or to read. Something I've been wanting to watch for a long time was this John Carpenter film, which I think was his first completed feature, Dark Star. Have you ever seen this?
No, I'm really ashamed to say that is one of my gaps. I haven't seen it. And I feel really bad because I feel like it's my job on the podcast to have seen movies like that. and yet here we are.
Well, I mean, I wish that we were doing an episode on that instead of what you fucking made me watch this week. This is, you know, you. I feel like you've been the more kind of partisan for your preferences lately. And in the spirit of bipartisanship, I've been kind of agreeing to things. And
do people hear the toxic work environment I have to deal with here?
Well, I'm sorry. I thought the camera was off. What do you want? But there have been things of late that you've wanted to watch. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And then it usually works out fine. This one was a really tough. This one was a really tough sit. And yet I had such a good time last night watching this film, Dark Star, which is made on a $60,000 budget. Absolutely shoestring budget. I enjoyed it tremendously. It's so, so good. It's a little rough around the edges at certain parts. There's a beach ball alien, like an alien that's just a beach ball. And it looks like it's like sub first season of the original Star Trek level special effects.
But, you know, I like that. I often like that more than slick special effects, because it sometimes creates an almost otherworldly quality.
Well, that's the thing. So I loved the, there's shots, like external shots of the ship and you know, planets and various kind of stellar phenomena and stuff, and I thought they looked great. It was kind of almost surreal. And since, you know, films of that era, I guess this is the early 1970s, you know, we had not been in space for very long, so people did almost still have this kind of fantastical otherworldly conception of what it would be like, which is really captured in the original Star Trek. Actually, one of the reasons why I think the original Star Trek watches better now than it did when I started watching it, which was, I guess, in the early 2000s, is that kind of corny, low rent quality, when the episodes aren't just totally corny, when the premises aren't corny, it actually makes it quite sinister when it needs to be. It can be quite spooky.
We've talked a lot. In fact, I think you and I have watched Plan 9 from Outer Space together, and I actually think that's a weirdly beautiful movie, because the cemetery set in that film, you know, it's probably like 10 feet wide by 4 feet deep, yeah. You know, maybe even less. It's incredibly small, just a black backdrop and some, you know, some shitty cardboard tombstones on the ground. It's so spare, and yet there's such an intensity to the visual style of it. It's so stripped down, but the movie takes it so seriously, and you're so stuck in that fake landscape that you can see almost nothing beyond that fake landscape. It becomes almost real to you as you're watching it. I find a visual style like that, impoverished though it is, quite hypnotic and moody in a strange way.
Yeah, and so let me tell you a bit about what this film's about, because also politically, it's really good. I mean, it has the same political subtext, I think, as the film Alien, which, you know, on the surface is a film about a monster. It's, you know, sci-fi horror. It's a monster stalking people in space who haplessly try to defeat it with technology and fail over and over again until one of them, you know, nukes the ship, and then even then only just gets away. But really, the film Alien is a movie about workers in space. It's a very constructive deviation from one of the typical traps of the sci-fi genre, which is not always a bad thing. But, you know, obviously in sci-fi, there's a temptation to present the future as this kind of perfect, you know, it's a utopia or whatever. And Alien and also Dark Star, I think, give us a version of the future where technology is advanced, but everyone still lives under capitalism, basically. 'Cause in both of these films, the spaceship kind of looks like just a, you know, a soulless corporate office tower in space. You know, there's that scene at the beginning of Alien where they're arguing about, you know, their wages and things like that. So, like, being able to travel great distances at high speeds and explore the heavens has not cured humanity of, you know, the relations of production that exist, you know, today and have existed for the past few hundred years. In Dark Star, the ship, which of the same name, has some kind of absolutely soulless mission where it carries these kind of smart bombs that are like, have a kind of artificial intelligence. You can talk to them, and its mission is to drop these on various planets, planets that don't seem to be inhabited. But in doing so, it's supposed to make the star systems ripe for colonization or something like that. We know that the crew has been out in space. They've experienced it for only 3 years, but they've been out in space for 20 years. And like the crew in Alien, it's abundantly clear from kind of the opening broadcast, which is a message they get from Earth from a general telling them that we can't actually send you anti-radiation technology because Congress has just made another round of budget cuts. So that tells us that, you know, these workers are completely disposable. There's some incredible details in the movie, like they all refer to each other by their last names, and there's this guy that hangs out in this little pod on the top of the ship, and he doesn't really come down into the mess or whatever to have, you know, these shitty meals from tinfoil that they have to eat. And somebody says, what's his first name? And then they're all thinking about it. And then the guy who was asked the question says, wait a minute, what's my first name? You know, they can't remember. And, you know, meanwhile, the computer, you know, offers them entertainment, which they don't seem to really be asking for. We're like, you know, in this soothing voice, it says like, you know, please enjoy this performance of The Barber of Seville and like things like that. It's really, really good. And it's got an unforgettable final sequence, which I won't spoil. I understand it's come out in a few different editions as well, so I might check out the others. There's a feature-length documentary about the making of it, which might be a fun thing for us to do an episode on sometime. The film itself, in the cut I watched, I mean, it's less than 90 minutes. I think it's like 80 minutes or something. And I think in the director's cut, it's maybe even shorter. I think they maybe cut down the beach ball stuff a bit because that was Well, that's supposed to be funny. And apparently when they screened it, even though audiences liked it, it didn't elicit many laughs. People didn't really understand that it was supposed to be funny. Anyway, a film also that's had an interesting kind of second life, despite being a bit of a flop as a cult classic. And having now seen it, I definitely think it deserves that status. I might actually write something about it when I return to work.
This is random, but, you know, I saw John Carpenter in concert about a year or two ago. One of those activities that...
Remember concerts?
Yeah, I can't do that anymore. Shoulder to shoulder with complete strangers. It was incredible.
This is like already hack territory, but can I just intervene for a second to say that every time I watch a movie now, you know, if there's like crowd shots and stuff, I'm like, why aren't these people wearing masks?
Oh yeah.
Sorry,
oh, yeah.
Sorry, we're in hack territory, but that is an actual thought that I have now every time I'm watching something. There's going to be a transition period whenever this ends.
He's retired from filmmaking now, and he mostly focuses on his music. And he was doing this concert where he went around, you know, playing the music that he composed for his movies, the themes and that sort of thing. And I remember when he came out, there was this gigantic round of applause, and he was on stage, and he did this face. I wish I could communicate a face via audio, but it was like,
well, I mean, the thing is, you can't.
What I would like to communicate is his face conveyed, yeah, that's right, I'm here, I'm the one. And then he goes to the center of the stage, and, you know,
it's the face Will will make if you know, circumstances ever permit
to do a
live show, or yeah, if you just run into him on the street.
And then, you know, he goes at the center of the stage, and he's got his keyboard, he's got a whole band, and, you know, his music's pretty minimal, so most of the songs are just him like doing three notes over and over again. So, you know, he's got his sunglasses on and he's doing those three notes, he's just kind of jiving. And he's got that face, that yeah, it's me face perpetually for the whole thing. And it's rare to be in the presence of such greatness, in the presence of such charisma.
I've been thinking about John Carpenter lately, even before I watched Dark Star. I guess he's been in the back of my head. And I realized that while I've never done the kind of dive into his work that I have for Cronenberg, who I guess in a way is kind of his peer, I actually have ended up seeing a lot of his movies and really enjoying them.
Because so many of them are just like part of our culture.
Yeah, I realize I've probably seen 6 or 7 Carpenter movies.
Oh man, you've got some gems in store. You know, even some of the ones that have bad reputations, like Vampires or Ghosts of Mars. I love them. You know, he has very few genuine clunkers, in my opinion.
Well, folks, if you like John Carpenter, you're gonna love next week's episode. Is all I'm gonna say. It's gonna be very spooky. But I suppose, even though we've been putting it off for a long time now because...
You've been putting it
excuse
off.
Excuse me.
I'm chomping at the bit.
All right. Well, I'm glad.
You know, here's the thing. It's like Luke watched this movie and he felt intimidated. He was like, there is this brotherhood. There is this peerage of comedians who know this joke. And I'm not part of it. But what Luke fails to understand is he is a part of it now because he's seen this documentary. He's been let into the secret coven. That's right. We watched the 2005 Penn Jillette Paul Provenza documentary, The Aristocrats.
Guy goes into a talent agent's office and says, the greatest act in the world.
It's a family act.
And the agent goes, well, what do you people do?
The world has changed, you know? Shockability has gone to a whole other level.
I do like to play with people's little danger zones.
And I come out dressed as Hitler in crotchless panties.
I'd like to see that, actually.
And I think you can put people to death for what goes on in the best versions of this joke.
My husband comes out, he bends down.
You know, now that I think back on it, it's probably wrong.
Although the premise is funny.
I remember that I fainted.
Well, Penn Jillette has long been, I think, you know, the intellectual center of this show and kind of our chief influence. I don't know if I...
In all the cultures that I have studied... You remember that from Michael Moore Hates America?
We might have to do a Michael Moore Hates America reunion episode or whatever. We can do it like the West Wing reunion episode where
we're getting at the vote for Biden.
Right. But what I mean is it's become so canonical that we don't even do original material. It's just the whole episode is just us performing the episode, but it's a script. And then, yeah, it's interrupted with PSAs by people who've been guests on the show. Who are just friends of the show, and they're like, yeah, vote for Joe Biden.
Yeah, what I remember about his appearance in Michael Moore Hates America was he had the affect of Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master.
Yeah, but like not self-aware, like not somebody who's doing this as a bit.
Not somebody who knows he's a snake oil salesman.
Yeah, and I loved, you know, the filmmaker who was so intimidated that he was in the presence of the mighty Penn Jillette, and he's just like sitting kind of an awkward distance across the couch from Penn Jillette, and is just like giving his best attempt at a sagely nod, you know, with every beat of what Jillette is saying. Anyway, yeah, I'm not surprised he had a hand in this. Can I just say, before we get into the content of this film, exceptionally bad piece of filmmaking. It's just...
Uh-huh.
It's just a series of interviews that are kind of awkwardly stitched together, and there's no thread. It's just them saying the same three or four things over and over again.
Well, 79% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes would disagree with you, Luke.
Well, yeah, who am I to disagree with the coven of critics who are much more in the know than I. But sorry, you enjoyed watching this film, so why don't you tell us why you made me watch it?
I would like to dispute your claim that I enjoyed watching it, although, I found it very boring. You know, midway through watching it, I sent you that Onion headline, holy shit, there's still 50 minutes left in movie. Because, yeah, you know, after 15 minutes, you've basically got what this movie is selling. I was interested in revisiting it because it comes from the center of the Michael and Us spiritual universe. 2005 post-Michael Moore documentary boom.
Uh-huh.
And more than most of the cultural artifacts from that era that we talk about, this is one where I think the entire meaning and reception of it would be very different if it were made and released today. You know, if this movie has a thesis, which is very debatable, but the thesis is free speech is good. I don't know if anybody says Lenny Bruce's name in this movie.
Yes, they do. I think Fred Willard says it.
Okay.
Something about how, I think it's Fred Willard, something about how the first time you hear it is incredible. Like it's like popping on a Lenny Bruce, you know, recording or something for the first time, which went right over my head because as we've established on the show, Lenny Bruce is the most famous comedian who isn't funny.
Well, this movie is a kind of culmination or a realization of all the principles that Lenny Bruce fought and died for, you know? But nowadays, if this movie were made, I think a documentary about free speech in comedy would be coded and received as being a right-wing film. At the time this movie came out, it was received as being a liberal film. I guess South Park would have been at the peak of its relevancy.
Oh, yeah.
The year after this, Borat came out. In fact, the same week that Borat came out was the week that Michael Richards had his famous meltdown at the Laugh Factory, you know, where he used the N-word a bunch of times and pretty much destroyed his career. I think what Michael Richards thought he was doing was leaning into this post-PC moment in comedy. Like, all the battles are won. We all know that sexism is over, racism is over, and comedy clubs are this kind of free speech zone where you can say whatever you want, and that's fantastic. The pendulum, I think, has swung for a lot of different and varying reasons in a different direction from this movie. So I guess we should say what the movie is about for those who don't know it.
I think everybody listening probably knows, but in case you're like the one listener who doesn't, I mean, yeah, basically there's this joke that
was brought over on the Mayflower by a bunch of comedians in a treasure chest. And it was passed down from generation to generation of comedian. Charlie Chaplin gave it to Buddy Hackett, who gave it to Lenny Bruce, who gave it to Carrot Top. And nobody from the outside world was able to see it.
Yeah, and basically it's more like the skeleton of a joke than, you know, an actual joke. It's a template and you can riff on it. So, you know, I guess the kind of crucial tenets are a family family walks into a talent agency. The comedian will then proceed to describe kind of the most despicable series of acts or events that they possibly can. And then the talent agent will say, well, that's a hell of an act. What do you call it? And they'll say the Aristocrats. So there's kind of an anti-punchline. You know, I'm annoyed. I had a whole joke all teed up for the start of this segment where I was going to talk about how I watched the Disney film The Aristocats instead because I'd misunderstood you. And then a bunch of the comedians in the film said the same thing. You know, they were like, oh, not to be confused with the Aristocats. and then I felt extremely ashamed and humiliated.
Well, you should have anticipated that because this is a 90-minute movie about a joke. So you can imagine that every possible bit of juice is going to be squeezed out of that orange.
By the way, the version that I was streaming was 3.5 hours long. Lest you think this was a mistake, it's because I guess it included all the special features where, like, it's 3.5 hours if you watch all the renditions of the joke that they include.
Who could resist?
Which, maybe, if this was 2005, I mean, how old was I in 2005? 16? Maybe, if this was 2003 and this had come out, I probably could have really, like, I can imagine being at, like, a 12th or 11th birthday party and sitting around with my friends and just, like, completely losing it at something like this. But for me, the moment's gone.
So we see something like 100 comedians. There's no discrimination between highbrow or lowbrow comedians. There's no sort of discrimination between various generations of comedians. So
yeah, you got your highbrow cerebral comedians, your intellectuals, Penn Jillette,
John Stewart,
Bill Maher. Yeah, you got
only highbrow. And you've also got Carrot Top and Emo Phillips, you know, Howie Mandel, people who are more like you and me, regular Joes, not modern day Prometheans like those guys.
You have a lot of people where I had never had them coded as a comedian because it's just like, oh yeah, you know, I think I saw this person had a bit part in like a Rob Schneider comedy that I somehow saw, like maybe on an airplane or something. This person was a comedian, like, okay, sure, I guess. Looking at the list of people that's in it, also apparently Carrie Fisher, was she a comedian?
She's not a comedian. She does a version of the joke where she repositions the joke as being about her own mother, Debbie Reynolds, making Singin' in the Rain as part of the Aristocrats. Most of the people in the movie fill in their own personal taboos and fetishes in the joke. There are some comedians who try to do clever variations on the joke or conceptual versions of it. So Kevin Pollak tells it in character as Christopher Walken. Sarah Silverman tells it in character, saying that she is the daughter from the act. There's a mime. There's a South Park animated bit where Cartman tells it. But the climax of the film, the agreed upon legendary moment, which is treated with the reverence of the crucifixion, is Gilbert Gottfried telling what we are led to believe was the first public telling of this joke, which took place 3 weeks after 9/11 at the Friar's Roast of Hugh Hefner, where he was bombing. He had made several bad taste jokes about the terrorist attacks. And then as a last-ditch Hail Mary play to win back the audience, he, with intense vigor and enthusiasm, told the Aristocrats joke and had Rob Schneider falling off his chair laughing. And if you have Rob Schneider falling off his chair laughing, that's a shortcut to the record books right there.
A man, a talent agent is sitting in his office. A family walks in. Man, woman, their two kids, and their little dog. Their talent agent goes, what kind of an act do you do? The father starts fucking his wife. The wife starts jerking off the son. The son starts blowing his father. You want me to start at the beginning?
So you didn't like the movie. Come on, there's got to be some parts you found funny.
Yeah, I mean, the odd part is pretty funny. I liked hearing from George Carlin.
You know, George Carlin's is funny because of the voice that he does. Yeah. He does it in this kind of like working class voice.
Yeah.
And so it's not so much what he's saying that's funny, but the way he's saying it.
No, the performance is good. George Carlin's just very funny. So he's able to do it. I don't know. I guess like I'm sort of burnt out on the idea that like just being gross isn't funny to me anymore. There has to be some some kind of like other element to it. Being gross can be really funny. A lot of the thing, like the idea of the joke kind of appeals to me in the abstract. And yet I found on delivery, a lot of these people, you know, it wasn't very funny to me. I also just don't happen to find a lot of people in this film very funny.
Carrot Top is in this movie. What are you talking about? Phyllis Diller is in this movie. How do you not find these people funny?
I was annoyed by something that you've already alluded to a couple times, which is the idea that this is some sort of like secret society and you're being let in on this like sacred ritual, and that, you know, these are the pros and they know how to do this. This is high concept stuff, and you mere mortals, first of all, you mere mortals could never, like, you could never do a version of this, which I'm pretty sure we could, like, right now do, like, a half-decent Aristocrats joke that is, like, as funny.
Yeah, the man shits on the stage and his wife shits on the stage and they roll around in it and the Aristocrats.
Right. And the shit, you know, it's especially, it's kind of viscous. It's got chunks in it, you know? It's like, that's kind of level of it. Pretty sure we could do a full rendition kind of on first go if we wanted to. But so, you know, that's premise number one that annoyed me. Like, you mere mortals could never. Premise two is the idea that the joke is so, you know, it's so high concept and complex that we need to have a 90-minute movie explaining it to you. So the film ends up being, you know, basically 90 minutes of people, you know, looking very serious and kind of, you know, wisely chin-stroking and saying stuff like, you know, to be a comedian is to push the boundaries. It's to go places, you know, where nobody is willing to go. And, you know, places
they're braver than the troops.
Places that make people even slightly uncomfortable or you know, or very uncomfortable, ideally. You know, it's like 90 minutes of people saying that. So I love this joke, you know, because it lets you push the boundaries, you know, places where people don't want to go. It's just 90 minutes of that. And I hate that as well, because it's like, even if you find the joke funny, the idea that it's the sole property of, you know, an exclusive club that includes such luminaries as, I don't know, Lisa Lampanelli and Howie Mandel, and I don't even know who Doug Stanhope is, but yeah, he's in it.
Both Penn and Teller.
Rip Taylor, who's a guy I only know about through Wayne's World, I think Wayne's World 2. Tia Carrera says he's a god in my country. He can't go down the street without being mobbed, which is a joke I never got. what's Rip Taylor's thing? He shows up in places and he throws, like, feathers or something.
He threw confetti, I think. He was very camp. Like, back before gay people were allowed to be out of the closet, you had Rip Taylor.
Okay. But so, yeah, I don't know, just the idea that this is some kind of special property, like, this is the Bohemian Grove of, like, transgressive comedy or something. I don't like it.
Yeah, so the most obvious, the most straw man and predictable modern day take on this movie, the one that Penn Jillette would give you, is you couldn't make this movie today because the snowflakes wouldn't be able to take it. You know, you'd be criticized for making light of rape and childhood sexual abuse and other very serious topics, even though, you know, we comedians, we're actually therapists. We're helping you cope with these topics by telling you about them. But it's really that kind of smug, insidery tone that is the most really dated element of it. Partly because, like, there have been whole revolutions in comedy since this movie was made. This movie is very proprietary of the idea of what is a comedian. You know, the comedian is the brotherhood. It's a special caste of society. Now comedians are everywhere. Comedian is a very amorphous category that includes like 25 million people on Twitter.
Everyone is a comedian now in the same sense that like everyone's a pundit. Everybody right. That writes about like comic book movies or whatever is like a fucking pundit that has to tell us their thoughts on every one of Trump's like latest hypocrisies or whatever. That's the same thing with comedy.
And it is just grossness for the sake of grossness. And there's no politics behind any of it aside from free speech is good.
Right. Or that just there's something inherently good about being able to sort of say this stuff with impunity. I have to say, I have obvious kind of objections to that, like, apolitical mid-2000s edgelord thing, and also its premises were fundamentally incorrect. Like, you already stated them, like, we can tell this stuff because politics is over, right? Racism is over, sexism is over, yada yada yada. So that's annoying. But between comedy that's just incredibly gross and comedy that is not comedy at all and is like people just making
good points
and being sanctimonious, or like the further level is like not even that, it's like Kate McKinnon like doing a weepy performance of Hallelujah as Hillary Clinton or whatever. If those are the two choices, I'm going with the former, not the latter. Because at least the former is actually still trying to be funny.
Kate McKinnon doing a weepy performance of Hallelujah is only like a few steps away from what Jon Stewart was doing on The Daily Show in the mid-2000s, right? Like, the sort of apolitical edgelords who were in The Aristocrats would have taken it as a given that somebody like Jon Stewart was comedy and modern-day stuff isn't, even though modern-day stuff is just, like, one step further in the evolutionary chain than the kind of good points comedy that was happening then.
Our by now well-established thesis on Jon Stewart is still relevant here, which is Stewart was a lot funnier in the Bush era because when that stuff was directed at kind of institutional power, it had a bite that it then kind of lacked when the Obama era started, and all of a sudden it's kind of fakely both sidesing equal opportunity offenders, you know, type stuff, but it's still very, you know, it's very much in the business of defending institutional power and kind of being like, well, yeah, you think that's bad, get a load of these clowns on Fox News, which is a lot less funny. So I don't know if political comedy absolutely can be funny. It just has to have an element that's more than just affirming the, you know, biases or the preferences of the people watching. Like, the problem I have with so much of SNL stuff and what I find so fundamentally unfunny about it is that it's just a sort of burlesque version of the shittiest lib takes you see on Twitter all day. Like, there's nothing. It's like, ooh, the Mr. Cheeto president is orange and his hands are small. And there's not actually even any political content to that.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. When I watch this documentary, I see a bunch of people who are talking about the importance of transgressing boundaries and comedy being this space for free inquiry, but I don't see a lot of that actually happening.
Well, yeah, what exactly are they inquiring?
Right, about? Like, they're just kind of affirming their own biases, which are very, very simplistic ideas about free speech being good and necessary. You know, there's a part in this documentary where Chris Rock, who appears very briefly, he mentions that vaudeville was running parallel to the Chitlin circuit, which is where black entertainers plied their trade for most of the 20th century. And because nobody in the Chitlin circuit ever had any hope of appearing on television, the comedy tended to be a lot dirtier there. And, you know, elsewhere, there's a moment where some of the female comedians like Lisa Lampanelli or Phyllis Diller, they talk about the routine and, you know, whether or not this is a boy's routine or whether or not vulgar comedy itself is for boys, et cetera, et cetera. These sort of issues of comedy history and the way that race and gender and class play into comedy history, they appear in this movie so briefly, so perfunctorily, that it's almost like Provenza and Gillette are checking boxes. And it's a shame because given the sheer amount of comedians in this movie from all sorts of generations, you could do a whole social history of comedy and vulgarity in comedy through the lens of this joke, talking about how standards changed and what the standards were from generation to generation. But the movie doesn't do that. It's this kind of undifferentiated soup of voices, just stream of consciousness hitting the same piano note over and over again.
And, you know, I actually thought this movie was something different because I thought that what it was going to be was a series of segments that was just people doing the jokes. So I was actually I wasn't particularly looking forward to watching it, but I was hoping to at least get some laughs. And instead, it's just these disjointed little sequences, like 5 or 10 seconds with particular people, and then it just cuts to someone else.
Actually, it would have been better that way because, you know, not one but two people in this documentary compare the act of telling the joke to John Coltrane playing jazz. And, like, if we are to accept that absurd premise just on its face, then let's actually hear these people play jazz, right?
Now, that's funny.
Scooby-Doo. 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 They call him Scooby-Doo. They call show Scooby-Doo. But Scooby doesn't do anything. Scooby is not involved. Half the time, Scooby's not even involved. He's just a bystander. It's one of the worst deals we've ever had. To call a show Scooby-Doo and then not deliver on Scooby-Doo. This is not a show about a dog sniffing its ass, okay? This is your show of where the mystery team are in a van and they walk around and they do, you know, they figure out, you know, mystery. They're solving mystery. And Scooby is not involved in any way, shape, form. Scooby, frankly, gets much too much attention, money. We're giving way too much attention to Mr. Scooby. and he's not doing anything. Scooby-Doo, he doesn't do. So we call him Scooby, but he doesn't do.
So something that genuinely made me laugh this week, there's a comedian, James Austin Johnson, at ShrimpJAJ on Twitter, has produced what I think is possibly the only Trump-inspired bit of comedy that is actually funny. And it's just Trump talking about Scooby-Doo. Now, I just showed it to you. It's a little difficult to articulate what is so funny about this, and maybe we shouldn't try. I don't know. But he gets Trump's cadence exactly right. And what I think is so funny is this is so close to an actual Trump rant about, you know, toilets or, you know, the Great Lakes or, you know, one of those classics. You know, it could almost be real. And I think one of the reasons liberal comedy has often faltered so much in trying to make fun of Trump is that it never actually captures how ridiculous he is. You can't really parody Trump, or it's very difficult to parody him because it's already a performance with Trump. It's already so kind of exaggerated. Anyway, there's probably not much more to say about that, but kudos to this guy. It's just some of the funniest shit I've seen all week.
I actually spent most of the last 4 years not watching any videos of Trump. I would very rarely hear him talk. I would consciously avoid it. You know, your Twitter timeline is full of people who seem to relish, you know, hate watching everything he does and posting angry tweets about them. And that always seemed like unnecessary emotional strain to me. But have you seen the couple videos that he did on the White House lawn right after having coronavirus?
Like the one from the balcony that people were upset, that people were like, this is fascist imagery or whatever.
No, I was thinking specifically that one where he's just on the lawn and he like his face is so spray tanned.
Oh, yeah. Or the one where he's talking, where he's addressing seniors. That one was pretty funny. And he's like, you may not know this, but I'm a senior myself. That one is pretty good.
And one of them, he starts with, it's me, your favorite president. Or, you know, he'll go off on those bizarre tangents.
Well, okay, sorry, can I interject? This is another reason why lib comedy with Trump is never funny, is because they don't realize that Trump is funny.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting to, because I think this guy has a certain affection for the bizarre tics and digressions and, you know, the John Coltrane-like jazz performance that is one of his speeches.